But 5 years ago, before the case closed, was finished, they, you know, they basically said that the judge will be responsible for 20 years of progress, of dropping crime. They said it's dangerous what she's done, and the Mayor Bloomberg at the time immediately appealed the case. Now, I can give the current mayor credit for dropping that appeal, but what people miss about the Floyd case, the Stop and Frisk case, is Stop and Frisk was just one of three parts.
We have 10 seconds.
Yeah. There's the summonses and the arrest, I wish were included, you know, then maybe our lawsuit wouldn't be necessary.
I want to thank you both for being with us, New York Police Lieutenant Edwin Raymond and Stephen Mang, director and producer of the documentary Crime and Punishment. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The World Arts Foundation and KBOO would like to invite you to the 34th anniversary and tribute to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., entitled We've Come This Far, Keep Alive the Dreams, on Monday, January 21st, 2019, from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center, 7600 Northeast Gleason Street. There'll be a host of civic leaders, choirs, the Jefferson Dancers, and of course, our own Victory Village Marketplace. Again, keep alive the dream. Monday, January 21st, from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center, 7600 Northeast Gleason, presented by the World Arts Foundation and broadcast live by KBOO Community Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is the proud co-sponsor of the third annual David Bowie Memorial Bike Ride on his birthday, Tuesday, January 8th. Come ride your bike around Portland with Diablo as we celebrate the life and music of David Bowie with a mobile dance party and sing-along. Again, that's the third annual David Bowie Memorial Bike Ride at 8 p.m. on January 8th at the corner of Southwest Broadway and Main in downtown Portland near the Schnitzer. More information can be found on the KBOO website under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a PSU professor faces disciplinary action after publishing hoax papers. Ex-convicts in Florida can now register to vote. And in international news, the European Union has hit Iran with new sanctions. Good evening. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 8th, 2019. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Portland State University has commenced proceedings against faculty member Peter Boghossian. Boghossian was an assistant professor of philosophy who co-authored a series of bogus research papers that parody what the authors dismiss as grievance studies. The PSU Review Board concluded that his participation in the elaborate hoax violates their ethical guidelines. The university is also considering a further charge that he falsified data. The three authors, including Boghossian, wrote 20 hoax papers that were submitted to reputable journals in gender, race, sexuality, and related fields. Seven of the papers were accepted, and three were in the process of being published when questions were raised by a skeptical Wall Street Journal writer. The hoax was named Sokol Squared, after a similar stunt pulled in 1996 by Alan Sokol, then a physicist at New York University. After the ruse came to light, the authors argued that their goal was to, quote, study, understand, and expose the reality of grievance studies, which is corrupting academic research. They say that scholarship that tends to social grievances now dominates some fields, while relaxed standards allow the publication of clearly ludicrous articles if the topic is politically trending. In response, a group of faculty members at PSU published a letter saying that their papers did not, quote, critique, educate, or inspire change in flawed systems, but rather humiliate entire fields while the authors gin up publicity for themselves without having made any scholarly contributions whatsoever. As of today, the voting rights of many Florida ex-convicts have been restored. In November, voters approved an amendment which restored the right to vote to ex-convicts who have served all terms of their sentence and did not commit sex crimes or murder. 10% of the adult population in Florida could not vote prior to this amendment. The law prohibiting ex-convicts from voting dates back 150 years and disproportionately affects Black and Hispanic communities. The amendment could add as many as 1.4 million people to the swing state's voter registry. The American Civil Liberties Union of Florida says former felons do not need to present proof that they completed their sentence. They can just fill out the application, signing under oath that their voting rights have been restored. The European Union has frozen the assets of an Iranian intelligence unit and two of its staff after the Netherlands accused Iran of two killings on its soil. The Netherlands also joins France and Denmark in alleging Tehran plotted other attacks in Europe. The move marks the first time the EU has enacted sanctions on Iran since the 2015 nuclear pact. They have also designated the intelligence unit and the two staff members as terrorists. The sanctions are partly symbolic, as one of the men affected is already in prison in Belgium. This follows accusations last year from Denmark and France that an Iranian government intelligence service pursued assassination plots on their soil. France, which has already implemented its own sanctions, has said there is no doubt that the Iranian intelligence ministry was behind a failed terrorist attack near Paris. The Dutch government has also publicly accused Iran of two separate killings in 2015 and 2017. Iran has denied any involvement in the alleged plots, saying the accusations were intended to damage EU-Iran relations. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif tweeted, quote, accusing Iran won't absolve Europe of responsibility for harboring terrorists. And now it's time for Labor History in 2 from host Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day sparring between Henry Ford and John L. Lewis spilled over into the press. The CIO formally declared their organizing drive of some 150,000 workers at the Ford Motor Company. John L. Lewis addressed a crowd of 25,000 the night before at the Detroit State Fairgrounds Coliseum, celebrating the recent organizing victory at Chrysler. Lewis thundered, "Henry Ford will change his mind." He added that the victories at Chrysler and General Motors came as a result of workers' dissatisfaction with their condition. Lewis also noted that Ford Motor Company prevented workers from joining unions through a system of intimidation and coercion. Ford insisted he would never recognize the UAW or any other union in response to sit-downs at Ford plants in Kansas City and St. Louis. Notoriously anti-Semitic, he then alleged that international banking interests financed CIO organizing drives. Ford maintained workers had no reason to celebrate organizing victories, claiming workers had lost through joining unions. He said they've had their freedom taken away. They pay money to the unions and get nothing in return. But Ford was also one of the few industrial employers that hired blacks. Organizing at Ford meant organizing black workers. It meant bringing black workers on as organizers and staffers in the UAW. The UAW waged a pointed campaign to attract black workers at Ford and concentrated efforts at the massive River Rouge complex. UAW leaders Homer Martin and Wyndham Mortimer urged black workers to join up with them, saying, quote, "We must solve together, not pitted against one another, all discrimination." It would take more than 4 years to finally organize at Ford, but black workers were at the forefront of that struggle. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
This morning, Mayor Bill de Blasio announced the creation of NYC Care, a $100 million health care plan that would ensure New York City's undocumented community. De Blasio's spokesman, Eric Phillips, stated, quote, "This is the city paying for direct comprehensive care, not just ERs, for people who can't afford it or can't get comprehensive Medicaid, including 300,000 undocumented New Yorkers. While New York City hospitals already cover the cost of emergency room visits for undocumented people, NYC Care would expand this coverage, extending under de Blasio's plan to non-emergency health care needs. De Blasio's announcement highlights the growing divide between state and federal policy regarding the United States' undocumented community, as it comes just hours before Trump is scheduled to give a nationally televised speech defending the proposed $5 billion border wall with Mexico. Trump continues to claim that those crossing the southern border are a security threat, which de Blasio has described as, quote, laughable. And now it's time for the Middle East Minute Plus. On today's episode, Angela Davis's Civil Rights Award has been rescinded over her support of Palestine.
This is the Middle East Minute Plus, and I am Salim Shahadeh. Angela Davis was to be honored by the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute and receive the Fred Shuttlesworth Human Rights Award at its annual gala next month. That reward was rescinded by the board of directors because of protests from Zionist organizations and the many Christian Zionists in Alabama who sharply criticized Davis's support for Palestinian liberation and the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement against Israel. Davis commented, quote, "I have indeed expressed opposition to policies and practices of the State of Israel, as I expressed similar opposition to U.S. support for the Israeli occupation of Palestine and other discriminatory U.S. policies." She also said, quote, "The rescinding of this invitation was thus not primarily an attack against me, but rather against the spirit of the indivisibility of justice," close quote. In other news, Israel has allocated 300 acres of land near Bethlehem for settlement expansion that would engulf the city. The Israeli occupational authorities proposed a similar plan in the past that was canceled due to international pressure. As of now, the local council of the settlement has built a small outpost in the place of the future expansion, marking their intentions to escalate its construction. Settlements are Jewish-only compounds built in coordination with the Israeli National Government and the Israeli occupational forces. International law views the entire West Bank as occupied territory and considers all Israeli settlement building there to be illegal. These settlements are built on stolen Palestinian land, infringing on the right of Palestinian sovereignty and the right of return for Palestinian refugees. The settlements prevent Palestinians from earning their livelihood from the land, and the series of Jewish-only roads that connect the settlements prohibit their movement. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint production of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
India's lower house of parliament has approved a bill that will grant residency and citizenship rights to non-Muslim immigrants. The legislation, which still requires approval from the upper house, would grant rights to Hindus, Jains, Parsis, and several other non-Muslim religious groups who migrated illegally from Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. Critics have called the proposal anti-Muslim and an attempt by Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party to boost its Hindu voter base before the general elections. The bill sparked protests in the northeastern state of Assam, where nearly 4 million people were stripped of their citizenship last year. Demonstrators set up blockades and burned effigies of the prime minister. An Assam police spokesperson said more than 700 protesters have already been arrested. Suhas Chakma, director of the New Delhi-based Rights and Risks Analysis Group, said the bill was, quote, "absolutely unconstitutional as it targets specific groups." He added that the bill is unlikely to pass through the upper house of parliament because the chamber is not controlled by the ruling party. And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture. On today's episode, Congresswoman Halland addresses the shutdown and the Saskatchewan government apologizes to Indigenous people.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. It's now week three of a partial government shutdown. Many tribal leaders fear it will hurt their communities. Matt Laszlo has a story from Washington.
Tribes rely on federal grants for lots of things, from health care to upkeep on roads. And with the Interior Department shuttered, along with another 25% of the federal government, some of the workers who administer those federal grants are forbidden from even coming to work and providing their normal services that are vital in many areas. Newly seated New Mexico Democrat Deb Holland says it's a recipe for disaster.
Indian country's been hit hard before the government shut down, so yeah, this doesn't help, obviously.
Holland was just sworn in last week with the rest of the freshman class, but it was bittersweet because the cloud of the shutdown hung over what was supposed to be purely a celebration for House Democrats, who are now back in the majority. Hahn says she supports Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who has thus far refused to give in to Trump's demands for more wall funding.
We need to come to a quick resolution, and I think that's what the Democrats have been proposing, so we'll see what we can do.
For now, there's no end in sight to this stalemate. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Peggy Flanagan was sworn in Monday as Lieutenant Governor of Minnesota. In remarks after taking oath of office, Flanagan, a citizen of the White Earth Nation, touched on Native history and her heritage.
My people talk about walking in two worlds, but one of my most treasured mentors encouraged me to reject that idea. I am an Ojibwe woman, and I am an Ojibwe woman all the time. I have a responsibility, especially because of those who came before me and cleared a path, to do good for my people all the time. I am an Ojibwe woman. I am a mother. I am a Minnesotan. This is a lens through which I see my world and the lens through which I will do my work as Lieutenant Governor.
Flanagan and Governor Tim Walz say they plan on working side by side in the office as a team and create opportunities for all people in Minnesota. Another government in Canada has apologized to Indigenous people, this time for what's called the 60 Scoop. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, Saskatchewan is the latest province to offer an apology.
Saskatchewan now joins Alberta and Manitoba in apologizing for the policy that began in the 1950s called the 60s Scoop. About 20,000 Indigenous children from across the country were taken from their birth families and relocated to non-Indigenous homes. The policy continued until the late 1980s. Those children lost their language, culture, and family ties. Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe offered the apology in the province's legislature on Monday, saying the consequences of the scoop are still being felt today, and it was a failure to the survivors, their families, and communities.
On behalf of the government of Saskatchewan, and on behalf of the people of Saskatchewan, I stand before you today to apologize. I stand before you today to say sorry. We are sorry for the pain and the sadness that you have experienced. We are sorry for your loss of culture and language. And to all of those who lost contact with their family, we are so sorry.
Some survivors cried during the ceremony, many of them remembering the loss of families they will never see. And they felt it was an apology that needed to be said. But some stayed away. Chief Bobby Cameron of the Federation of Sovereign Indigenous Nations said the apology was empty if it doesn't come with action or child welfare reform. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
In Canada, police violently raided an Indigenous encampment that was blockading construction of a fracked gas pipeline. In response, anti-pipeline activists staged a sit-in at a forum in Ottawa today, where Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was set to make a speech to Indigenous leaders. The Coastal GasLink Access Pipeline is being constructed in northern British Columbia through unceded Wet'suwet'en territory. Here is a clip of the moment the mounted police came over the gates late yesterday and started making arrests to enforce the Coastal GasLink injunction.
You're actually
stop
breaking
it!
Someone's arm.
Stop it!
Stop
it!
You're
breaking
his arm!
We're
breaking
his
arm!
Young man, go back!
Young
man!
Young man!
Young man!
Following the raid on the encampment yesterday afternoon, over 50 solidarity protests took place today across Canada, the U.S., and in other parts of the world. Canadian author and activist Naomi Klein said this marks a shameful day for Canada, which has marketed itself as a progressive leader on climate and Indigenous rights. Klein condemned the government's arrest of First Nations land defenders in order to push for a gas pipeline that is entirely incompatible with a safe climate. For more, we go to this report from the Real News Network about the pipeline and the blockade.
Well, we're here to talk right here.
Let's go back to your car, because you guys don't have permission to come across here.
This is
we can go back over there and talk about your vehicle.
For almost a decade,
The Unist'ot'en clan of the Wet'suwet'en Nation have used a checkpoint to keep multiple oil and gas pipelines from being constructed on their territory in northern British Columbia.
What are you doing here?
We're just from Coastal GasLink. We're doing non-invasive testing.
Yeah, you gotta leave.
Are they safe to be here right now, though?
No, you're perfectly safe.
Okay.
Do I look like I'm trying to harm you?
No, not at all.
I'm peacefully asking you to leave because you're trespassing.
The latest such project comes from TransCanada, the same corporation behind the Keystone XL pipeline, who now wants to build a multi-billion dollar natural gas pipeline to the Pacific Ocean that would cut through hundreds of miles of unsurrendered indigenous lands. Last week, TransCanada took two prominent Wet'suwet'en leaders to court, asking for an injunction to remove the checkpoint and allow construction to begin.
It's not just this little courthouse. The whole world is watching what Canada is doing. But since I was a little girl, I was told that's our territory. They didn't tell us it belonged to somebody else, that I had to ask permission from somebody else to go on my territory. All decisions regarding territory goes through our feast hall. I didn't see no pipeline company coming into our feast hall, so they didn't follow the process, so they were the ones that messed up, not us.
Inside the courthouse, TransCanada's lawyer entered 2,400 pages of evidence. Meanwhile, the lawyer for the Unist'ot'en was only able to prepare a handful of affidavits.
And they only gave us like 2 weeks to try and prepare for this. We didn't have a lawyer until yesterday. We've been trying to get legal advice from different people, and it's difficult because everybody's busy this time of year and the company knows it.
The courtroom filled with Wet'suwet'en chiefs and other members who watched silently for 6 hours as lawyers for both sides failed to properly pronounce the names of their clans. 24 hours later, the judge granted TransCanada an injunction ordering the opening of the gate for pipeline workers to begin construction.
I knew this was going to be a lopsided situation. You look at the federal government, they make the laws that go into the court systems, and they provided 60% of this partnership funding. So they're already right there in conflict. So it's in conflict. We're going into their courts, which they have lots to lose. So they're backing the other parties, even though everything they said were lies in their affidavits and in their application, were all lies. And we had to just sit there and listen to their lies and just shake our head. That's not true. That's not what happened.
The injunction includes an enforcement order requesting the RCMP, Canada's National Police, force the gate open and, if necessary, arrest those that get in the way. Just hours before the injunction went into effect, members of the neighboring Gidimden clan installed a second checkpoint, making it impossible for TransCanada to arrive at the original checkpoint located further down the road.
Hi, my name is Bob Couture.
And we'd like to get permission to get access to go to the bridge, if we may, so I can post a notice.
Ndu Esla.
Pardon?
Ndu Esla.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Gidimden Bianca.
Are you granting us access or not?
This is Gidimden territory.
Yes.
Yes.
I understand.
You can't ask me for permission. You have to ask permission from the hereditary chiefs of the Gidimden clan.
Okay.
My name is Vic, and I'm with the Coastal GasLink project. And the reason for Mr. Couture to be here is to post the injunction that was granted by the BC Supreme Court to allow us access to do the work.
Yeah. Canadian courts do not have any jurisdiction on Wet'suwet'en territories. The Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs have full jurisdiction on Wet'suwet'en territories. We have for thousands of years, since time immemorial. We have never ceded or surrendered any of that jurisdiction. So I am not here to argue that point with you.
And we're not here to argue with you either.
Yeah,
so what we're going to do we're going to post the injunction.
It's upside down, and that has nothing to do with the injunction. That's his instructions.
Thank you very much.
They're physically blocked from passage. Post at that location.
take a staple gun, peg, and hatchet.
The hereditary chiefs held a press conference at the new checkpoint to show their support for the action. In 1997, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that the Wet'suwet'en people had never given up their rights and title to 22,000 square kilometers of northern British Columbia, and the Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs were recognized as the relevant authority on that territory.
The right and title, United Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and reconciliation, all these words have been used quite recently by governments. How do you think that reconciliation is going to be achieved when issues like this continue to arise here on the territory?
How could there be reconciliation when they won't even acknowledge who we are? No elected official at any level can outspeak the Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs. We're standing up for what the United Nations has said. Now it's time for the Prime Minister of Canada to stand up and say, we said we would uphold it, we said we would implement it, but they've done nothing but talk about it. We, as Indigenous people of this country, are the ones that need to uphold this ourselves. They need to follow what we say. We are not here to follow them.
As this report is released, helicopters are regularly flying over the two checkpoints, and it is not clear on whose land the police consider the new checkpoint to be on.
I think that everybody's quite aware of the environmental impacts of the pipeline poses. But even more than that, this is about Indigenous sovereignty. We cannot stand by and let our yinta, the land, be destroyed for all the generations to come. That would be against Wet'suwet'en law. So there's a bigger picture about the changes that are happening in the world and the changes that broader society need to recognize and need to accept.
While in court, TransCanada's lawyer argued that the only viable route for a pipeline to cross the mountain ranges of the Northwest goes through Wet'suwet'en territory. This proposed pipeline is just one of many that would carry fossil fuels extracted through fracking and tar sands development to markets in Asia and elsewhere. It might even be said that the future of this humble gate is central to the future of energy, ecology, and Indigenous sovereignty on our planet.
Madagascar's High Constitutional Court has declared former leader André Rajoelina as the winner of the country's presidential election. The court said that Rajoelina won with more than 55% of the vote in the runoff election that took place last month. His main opponent, former President Marc Ravalomanana, received around 44% of the vote. Ravalomanana denounced the runoff results and alleged massive fraud on Election Day and during vote counting. However, the High Court has rejected the complaints filed and upheld the election results. Rajoelina announced to his supporters that, quote, "The victory is not only mine, it is also the victory of the Malagasy people."
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 6 for preference. Then at 7, calculated conversation. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with occasional showers and a low of 41 degrees. Tomorrow will be cloudy with periods of rain later in the day and a high of 52 degrees. Today in history, in 1962, Leonardo da Vinci's masterpiece, The Mona Lisa, was exhibited for the first time in the United States at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. Over 2,000 dignitaries came out to view the famous painting, including then-President John F. Kennedy. The painting, on loan from the Louvre Museum in Paris, then traveled to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. The quote of the day is from artist Leonardo da Vinci, who said, quote, "Art is never finished, only abandoned."
The victim of the first fatal police shooting of 2019 in Oregon has been identified by the state medical examiner as 36-year-old André C. Gladden. The shooting took place at the home of Desmond Pascaya, who stated that Gladden appeared on his front doorstep around 1 p.m. last Sunday asking for help as he believed someone was trying to kill him. Pascaya offered him some money, which was refused, then asked him to leave, but the request was ignored. According to Peskaya, Gladden fell asleep on his porch, and that is when he called the police. Portland police officer Vosu responded to the call. Upon his arrival, Gladden panicked and started beating on the front door, saying Officer Vosu had a fake badge. At this time, Peskaya opened his door, allowing Gladden to enter, followed immediately by Officer Vosu. The two began wrestling in the living room, then Vosu allegedly tased Gladden, who was not stopped by the shock and pulled out a knife, at which point Vosu fired his weapon. Gladden was declared dead on arrival at a local hospital. Portland Cop Watch is a nonprofit group promoting police accountability through civilian action. Founded in 1992, their goal is to see a police bureau free of corruption, brutality, and racism. Today, Portland Cop Watch released an updated version of its database that tracks deadly force incidents in Oregon. The database begins with the 2010 death of Aaron Campbell in Portland. It includes 231 other incidents involving law enforcement in the state, resulting in 131 deaths. The list was sent to Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum, accompanied by a letter. The letter reminds the AG's office that it is supposed to post information online on at least those incidents resulting in deaths. Currently, only 4 of 19 such incidents that occurred in 2018 are available on the state's website. The letter to the AG breaks down the information by location, law enforcement agency, and, to the extent possible, race, gender, and veteran status. Of the 231 incidents, 44, or 19%, involved the Portland police. 15 of the suspects were African American, representing 6% in a state that is only 2% black. Additionally, 64% of incidents occurred in just 5 counties, 59 in Multnomah, 34 in Washington, 24 in Marion, 16 in Jackson, and 15 in Clackamas. The Deadly Force Incident Database and the letter to the Attorney General can be found online at portlandcopwatch.org. Now it's time for the daily national newscast from the Public News Service. The Public News Service has bureaus in 36 states dedicated to news in the public interest.
The Public News Service daily newscast for Tuesday, January the 8th, 2019. I'm Mike Clifford. President Trump plans to address the nation tonight on border security and his demand for a wall. Also on the Tuesday rundown, Tennessee's governor grants clemency to a sex trafficking victim, and we'll let you know why the Chesapeake Bay is more polluted for the first time in a decade. Topping our news, President Donald Trump unleashed an offensive Monday to persuade Americans that a humanitarian and security crisis on the southern border must be addressed before a government shutdown can end. That from the New York Times. They report that Vice President Pence briefed reporters in a hastily arranged session, part of an orchestrated effort to sway Democrats, who said the government must reopen before they negotiate on Trump's demand for $5.7 billion to begin his border wall. The Times notes the shutdown is already the second longest breakdown in government funding in the nation's history, affecting about 800,000 federal workers, many of whom will not get paid for the first time this week. And in one of his last acts as governor, Bill Haslam granted the prospect of freedom to Cyntoia Brown, commuting her life sentence for murder with eligibility for parole in early August. Antoinette Kerr has our report.
Brown, who says she was a victim of child sex trafficking, was sentenced in 2006 to life in prison for killing 43-year-old Johnny Allen 2 years earlier. Brown, who was 16 at the time, says Allen solicited her for sex and reached for a pistol before she fatally shot him at his home. Human rights organizers rejoiced at the governor's decision, says Derry Smith, CEO of End Slavery Tennessee.
Cyntoia, in her original transcript, was referred to continually as a teen prostitute. We understand today there's no such thing. If a 16-year-old is being sold for commercial sex, she's a human trafficking victim, and she needs services and not criminalization. The governor recognized that.
Haslam said in a statement, the decision comes after careful consideration of what is a tragic and complex case.
Advocates say that Brown's case and Governor Haslam's decision have both contributed to Tennessee leading the way in anti-trafficking legislation and action. And civil rights groups in Michigan are celebrating a new directive from Governor Gretchen Whitmer that bans discrimination against LGBTQ people who work for the state or its contractors or who service state properties.
The directive specifically forbids discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity.
Erin Knott with the group Equality Michigan says the move will affect thousands of people.
Executive branch employees aren't going to have to worry about discrimination hurting their ability to support themselves. Conservation officer can't harass same-sex partners if they're camping in our state parks later this summer. Or MDOT contracted construction companies, as an example, won't be allowed to discriminate in the hiring of LGBT workers.
Whitmer's move is consistent with the position taken last May by the Michigan Civil Rights Commission, which interpreted the state's existing prohibition on sex discrimination to include sexual orientation and gender identity. However, current state law, specifically the Elliott-Larsen Civil Rights Act, which originally passed in 1976, does not include LGBTQ protections in its ban on discrimination in employment, housing, education, and in public accommodations and services. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Back in December, a coalition of civil rights and health groups sent a letter asking Whitmer to support a number of policy changes. They include budgeting more money for family planning. Most grandparents look forward to an afternoon or weekend with their grandchildren, but many are now raising their grandkids because their own children are living in the streets or addicted to drugs. We get the details from Roz Brown.
Nationwide, New Hampshire has one of the higher rates of opioid-related deaths due to overdoses, which is contributing to grandparent-led families. Susan Allen Samuel with the National Alliance on Mental Illness New Hampshire served on a state commission that looked at how grandparents can be helped. She says many are nearing retirement age and now coping with the stress of rearing young children.
We've got a whole generation of people that aren't even connecting with their own peers because they've got little kids in the house now. And they've not only got their grandchildren, but those are traumatized children that are separated somehow and maybe back and forth from their parents.
It's estimated there are at least 10,000 New Hampshire grandparents raising their grandchildren, with 60% still in the workforce.
Finally, for the first time in a decade, Chesapeake Bay became more polluted last year, according to a new report from the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. And the main source of that pollution came from Pennsylvania.
The Foundation's State of the Bay report claims that extreme weather from climate change, including record rainfall in the summer, caused large amounts of dirty water to flow into the bay. In particular, increased pollution from farms and city streets went into rivers and streams, particularly the Susquehanna River. Harry Campbell, the Pennsylvania executive director for the Foundation, says more than half of Pennsylvania drains into the Chesapeake Bay watershed.
It's all about Pennsylvania's rivers and streams and the lands that drain into them. And if we were to sustainably and successfully address this issue, we have to start at that source.
Campbell recommends cost-effective green solutions such as planting more trees along city streets, rivers, and streams. This helps absorb nitrogen and other pollutants from the air and running off the land. I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum reporting.
You can find the Foundation's State of the Bay report online at cbf.org. I'm Mike Clifford, and you have been newsing and cruising with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
On Thursday, Joshua Tree State Park in California will become the latest in a string of public recreational areas to close due to the government shutdown. The closure is because of a lack of park rangers and maintenance staff who have been furloughed in the shutdown, causing park sanitary facilities and trash cans to overflow. Volunteers have attempted to maintain the facilities but have been unable to keep up with the demand. Without rangers on hand, people have also caused damage to the park itself by driving off paved roads and defacing the namesake Joshua trees. In Yosemite National Park, human waste has destroyed animal habitats near roads despite local citizens organizing work crews to try and control the problem. Excessive garbage has become a problem as well. Closer to home, the road into Crater Lake has been closed due to the shutdown preventing the park toilets to be emptied. Rangers are even worried that human waste could find its way into the lake itself. And now, from the Yale Center for Environmental Communication, it's Climate Connections. On today's episode, the authors of a new book say nuclear energy is worth another look, as coal is a bigger threat.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Reducing global warming is a huge challenge, but Joshua Goldstein, professor emeritus at American University, says it's not impossible.
We can do things about it if we follow some successful examples, especially countries like Sweden and France, who decarbonized their economy really quickly with a combination of renewables and nuclear power.
Many people argue nuclear power is just too expensive. But in his new book, Bright Future, Goldstein and co-author Stefan Quist argue that it's possible to bring the cost way down, and that countries such as South Korea have already done so. Other people have safety concerns, but Goldstein says what's far more dangerous than nuclear is continuing to burn coal. The world's largest source of electricity, coal is a huge source of the carbon pollution that causes global warming. It also creates harmful air pollution that kills hundreds of thousands of people each year. So Goldstein says replacing coal should be a top priority. And though solar and wind are important,
they don't add up at the scale that we need.
So when considering our energy future, he asked people to weigh their concerns about nuclear against the threat already caused by burning fossil fuels. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Environmental groups in Oregon have decided to withdraw from talks on how to manage the state's rebounding wolf population. The groups say they are concerned about what they call a broken process. They also worry that state wildlife officials are trying to make it easier to kill wolves that eat livestock without first considering other options. This announcement comes after months of negotiations to update rules on how and when wolves can be killed. Recently, wolf populations have increased and they've spread farther west and south. Environmental groups said they would collectively and actively oppose the wolf management plan proposed by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The groups include Oregon Wild, Defenders of Wildlife, Cascadia Wildlands, and the Center for Biological Diversity. The groups are particularly against a provision that would allow the state or deputized private citizens, such as ranchers, to kill wolves after two documented attacks on livestock herds by the same pack. The provision would also allow them to keep the wolf pelts. Groups feel that the agency's plan also favors hunters, who argue that more wolves mean fewer deer for them to hunt. Most Oregon wolves live in remote northeastern areas where cattle, sheep, and goats graze on private land and federally managed forests. The wolves lost their endangered status in Oregon in 2015, when their population hit 81 wolves. The species is no longer federally protected in the eastern third of the state. As of April 2018, there were only around 124 wolves in Oregon. Current Cast is a daily podcast that highlights issues affecting one of our most precious resources, fresh water. On today's episode, the western Lake Erie Basin is an important stopover site for migrating songbirds.
Protecting birds on the ground and in the air. On this Current Cast. The western Lake Erie Basin is an important stopover site for migrating songbirds. And that means development in the region can impact our feathered friends.
It's a constant vigilance and concern. For birds, not only is the habitat a concern, but you know, structures.
That's Mark Shieldcastle of the Black Swamp Bird Observatory in Ohio. He says, for example, spinning wind turbines can be a hazard to birds in flight. So, although wind energy helps prevent global warming,
there are a lot of concerns. Sighting is important. You know, putting turbines in a major migration area such as the Western Basin is maybe not the wisest thing to do.
Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
One of the nation's most well-known retailers, Sears, has reached an 11th-hour deal to remain open, for now. Attorneys for Sears said they reached an agreement with a hedge fund controlled by the chairman and former CEO of Sears, Eddie Lampert. The deal will keep 425 of the stores open under certain conditions. Lampert's bid is the only one that is designed to keep Sears stores open. It is still possible that another entity will bid more for the assets than Lampert is offering, again putting the company on the path of shutdown. Without an agreement, Sears faces the possibility of liquidation. The final deal will also need approval from the U.S. bankruptcy court judge, Robert Drain. Judge Drain called Lampert's preliminary agreement, quote, a good development. Sears filed for bankruptcy in October, but said it hoped to use the process to stay in business. However, many retailers end up going under after filing, despite plans to stay open, such as Toys R Us, Radio Shack, and Sports Authority. Next up, it's The Week in Water from H2O Radio. On today's episode, because of the government shutdown, labs have closed, scientists have left the field, and data collected is not being analyzed. Brazil's new president has already acted against environmental protections and indigenous people, and there may be a new eco-friendly way to make plastic for bottles, bags, and packaging.
Trump's shutdown stops science, but not his plans for Arctic drilling. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Climate change research and efforts by the government to monitor the environment have come to a halt due to the current federal shutdown.
The New York Times reports that across the country, labs have closed, scientists have left the field, grant monies are threatened, and planning for future studies, some of which are time-sensitive, have been disrupted.
NASA's client scientists are not around to analyze data collected by satellites, but other staff are in place to make sure the spacecraft are functioning and safe.
E&E News reports that nearly all employees of the Department of Agriculture working on climate change efforts are furloughed, and travel bans during the shutdown will result in no officials attending major conferences like that of the upcoming American Meteorological Society.
Efforts by the administration to replace rules that would reduce emissions under the Clean Power Plan are in turmoil because no one is there to review public comments about the proposed rollback, and no staff is available to prepare responses.
But the shutdown is not stopping the Trump administration from moving forward to open more areas in the Alaskan Arctic to oil and gas drilling. The Bureau of Land Management is proceeding with four meetings as a part of an environmental review process, some of which occurred last week.
A former Interior Department employee told radio station KTOO that she had never seen anything like that in prior shutdowns, as all non-essential work was stopped and employees were not even supposed to be checking emails.
The new president of Brazil, in office only a few days, has already acted against environmental protections and indigenous people.
Jair Bolsonaro was inaugurated on New Year's Day and within hours transferred the regulation of new indigenous reserves to the agricultural ministry, which The Guardian reports is controlled by the powerful agribusiness lobby.
The move will result in more deforestation and violence against native peoples, according to one of their representatives. Environmentalists maintain that protecting the indigenous people's areas is a way to protect the forest, not to mention the people who live there.
Most of the Amazon rainforest is in Brazil, and CNN reports that it has lost 20% due to deforestation since the 70s, making way for cattle ranching, farming, mining, and hydropower.
But Brazil's new environment minister has questioned whether his country's Amazon region has experienced high deforestation and has called the global warming debate innocuous and secondary.
Last year, Brazil withdrew its offer to host next year's UN climate talks to move the Paris Agreement forward. While Bolsonaro has threatened to pull out of the agreement entirely, it's not yet clear if he will do so.
There may be a new eco-friendly way to make plastics for bottles, bags, and packaging. In a report from Tel Aviv University, researchers say they've made a material derived from microorganisms that feed on seaweed.
Unlike plastics made from petroleum, which takes centuries to degrade and produce toxins, the new material produces zero toxic waste and it recycles into organic matter.
While some factories can already produce these bioplastics, the authors say this new method is better because it doesn't require agricultural land and fresh water. Countries with freshwater shortages like Israel, China, and India may be able to switch away from traditional plastics.
And in the meantime, The Guardian has published a list of ways people can reduce their plastic footprint. One way is to stop using shower gels that come in plastic containers, replacing them with good old soap. And liquid detergents can be found in recyclables or refillable containers.
Also on the list is switching to bamboo toothbrushes instead of plastic and buying things like rice and pasta in bulk to avoid small plastic packaging. Speaking of which, foil, which is recyclable, is preferable to film wraps.
To learn more about how to reduce your plastic footprint, go to our website at h2oradio.org.
Climate change may be having an effect on whether baby turtles become males or females. Sea turtles lay their eggs in the sand on beaches and bury them. The temperature of the sand will determine the gender of the hatchlings.
As Eartha reports, a new study done at a marine park in West Africa predicts that under the worst-case climate scenario, more than 90% of the turtles in that region would be females. And even if robust action is taken to stem warming, nearly 80% will still be girls.
Another study earlier this year found that turtles of the Great Barrier Reef, far away from West Africa, were almost all female for the past 20 years.
But the researchers in the new study had some good news about the turtles in West Africa. Those creatures can lay their eggs in coastal forested areas, resulting in males, and leave some of them in warmer sands to become female.
And finally, Christmas may be a distant memory by now, but Christmas trees don't have to be. According to new research, instead of kicking that pine tree to the curb where it will slowly rot in a landfill and emit greenhouse gases, it could have a second act as mouthwash, adhesives, or even paint.
Unlike other wood products or plants, pine needles are not suitable for manufacturing or energy because they're composed of lignocellulose, which is a complex polymer.
But Cynthia Carty from the University of Sheffield has found pine needles are suitable for something else. They're great feedstock for creating other chemicals.
Carty discovered that when pine needles are broken down with heat and environmentally friendly solvents like glycerol, they become a liquid product called bio-oil and a solid byproduct, biochar.
The bio-oil contains chemicals that are used in many industries. Glucose is used in the production of sweeteners for food, and acetic acids are used for making paint, adhesives, and even vinegar. The biochar is a great soil amendment and helps prevent nitrogen runoff from croplands.
And the whole process of recycling pine needles is sustainable because there is zero waste. As Carty notes, the tree that adorned your house over the holidays could be turned into paint to decorate it in the future, painting it green, so to speak.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 8th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Emily Gresham-Beamer, Yasmin Kobanoglu, and Al Kahn. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Liam Delta. The director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Wednesday Talk Radio, hosts Jacqueline Keeler and Paul Rowland take a critical look at the likely presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren, with guest Jenny Monet. At 9, the radio activist talks to the Portland Parents Union about school kids facing push-out in the classroom, then a visit from Unite Oregon and their work combating hate crimes. At 10, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, the Dirtbag talks fruit tree care and veggie garden planning, plus your gardening questions. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
To the max. to the front, to the back. Put your foot on the rock and back your foot. Don't stop, put your foot on the rock. I've got to stop, oh, that's all my own. You got Lady B on the microphone. I'm no Perry Johnson or Butterball. I just stopped by to freak out to all. I got a little black book with 1,000 pages with a listing of men that range from all ages to the beat, y'all. Check it out, y'all. Don't stop. I said Jack and Jill went up the hill to have a little fun. But stupid Jill forgot the bill, and now they have a son. The pot was a hot, the corn wasn't on. The butter didn't melt to the crack of dawn. I said, you bring the butter and I bring the salt. If you don't freak, then it ain't my fault. Said a hip hop, a hip hip a hop, hip hip dibby 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 bop. I said a hip a hop, but don't stop, baby, don't stop, baby, don't stop. Say do it, do 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 it, do it, do it good. I just do it, there ain't nothing to it. It's Lady B and the disco fluid. Say the hip hop, but don't stop. We're gonna shock the house. I'm a mean, I'm a queen, I'm a sex machine. Not the shape, the wrinkles out of straight legged feet. I'm gonna tell it to you once, tell it to you straight. I'm the baddest politician since Watergate. I just show, I'm in the house. I just show what it's all about. I go down, go down, go down, go down. Uh-oh, I go down. From coast to coast, PJ's the man. Said he's the one with the master plan. He's pleasing ladies day to day. And this is what my man would say. I'm listed in the yellow pages all around the world. And I'm wanted by the cops and the FBI for bugging out you sweet young girls. Sweet ladies, young ladies, just the ones that I don't see. If I don't get a chance to freak with you, I leave your telephone number with me, you see. Cause I'll call you up 1,000 times at the crack of dawn. If your mama don't mind, to the beat, y'all. Check it out, y'all. Don't stop.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Next up is Transpositive, and after that at 7 o'clock we have Calculated Conversation with David and Ken. So stay tuned right after these brief messages.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Counter Rally for Reproductive Justice on Saturday, January 19th from 1 to 4 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland. On the 46th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, this rally is in support and solidarity with all people who have considered, are considering, or have received abortions. It is a protest of the Rally to the Oregon Right to Life March and will celebrate our victories in imagining a future where every person has access to the reproductive health care they want and deserve. Again, that's the Counter Rally for Reproductive Justice on Saturday, January 19th from 1 to 4 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square on the southwest corner at Morrison and Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Ken Stringfellow and John Auer from the Posies on Thursday, January 17th at 8 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. John Auer and Ken Stringfellow play Posies songs with a focus on the compositions, melodies, and harmonies. There'll be two guitars, two voices, and the occasional piano. Again, that's Ken Stringfellow and John Auer from the Posies on Thursday, January 17th at 8 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. This is an all-ages event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive. My name is Emma and I use she and her pronouns.
Hi, I'm Guinevere and I use she and her pronouns.
I'm Toby Meltzer and I use he and him.
I'm Sarah Leigh. I use she and her.
And I'm Jean Bryant. I use she and her.
And we're here. We're